When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Do you know what would really boost my morale, Duncan?
What would boost your morale, Rob?
What would boost my morale, Duncan, is if people were to like, subscribe and leave a 5-star review for this podcast on their preferred podcast app.
It would boost my morale too, Rob.
Like a tot of rum. This week, I'm taking the podcast deep into enemy territory for reasons that don't really make sense, as we watch Sam Fuller's 1962 Burma action movie, Merrill's Marauders. Coming along for the ride is a half-witted yokel who joined the army when he heard it was taking his favourite mule. Hello, Duncan Weldon.
Hello, Rob.
Duncan, you picked this film.
I did. I know you're sort of, you know, handing over there. So for listeners, you know, Rob sort of gestured at me there, so this is your fault.
Okay,
a few reasons. One, we haven't really done a sort of World War II in Asia war movie. We've done a prisoner of war movie, which I think is slightly different. But, you know, it's... And, you know, when I think back, there aren't a great deal compared to what we get in, you know, focusing on Europe about World War II. This is one of the... one of very few. And it's a film which I first saw with my grandfather, who had been in the sort of 14th Army fighting in Burma, and was always, I think, slightly annoyed that there were a lot of films about sort of 1940 Dunkirk, an awful lot of movies about sort of D-Day to the end of the war, Arnhem, a lot of desert war movies, but very, very few movies about Britain's war out in against Japan. I presume in 1962 when this film came out, was probably quite happy someone was finally doing a Burma movie, and they managed to do it about the 3,000 odd Americans in Burma as opposed to the more than a million Imperial and Commonwealth or Chinese soldiers. But it was at least a Burma movie.
Yes, because it's not like there's no action in Burma. Yeah. You know, and it's not like there's no exciting stories. There's you've got sort of Chindits and Ord Wingate sort of fighting kind of guerrilla warfare. You've what there are is prisoner of war movies. There's Bridge on the River Kwai, there's King Rat, there's Empire of the Sun a bit later, but you know, there's a lot of being a prisoner at the hands of the Japanese. But if you sort of imagine the history of the war as told through cinema, it just basically feels like in 1942, Britain surrenders everything east of Suez.
Goes to prisoner of war camp and then later it's interesting. It's kind of, you've got like, you know, Imphal and Kohima are very large, important battles. You've got the Chindits, like you say, with Ord Wingate, who, you know, is calling out for a biopic film. Very, very strange.
He's very strange. The more you read about Ord Wingate, the stranger he is.
Yeah, so you've got all of that sort of Chindit stuff with like this very interesting character heading it. You've got all of the stuff around, like, you know, you've got a British army cut off for a bit in the Arakan box being supplied by parachute drops. You've got all of these things that would make for exciting war movies, but we just haven't done it. It's not, you know, I was thinking... You know, the Indian Army in the Second World War was the largest volunteer army in the war. And I can't think of a single film about the Indian Army in World War II fighting the Japanese. You get the odd sort of, you know, Indian soldier turning up in Europe in movies about Europe or particularly North Africa. But yeah, just, it's
don't
just
even get
strange...
that many of them in North Africa, considering how many of them there were in North Africa. Yeah,
it's just a very strange cinematic blind spot. So what we are left with is films like this, which is, I think, great film, but it's a very, very American telling of Burma.
Yeah, and there are some, I was thinking about films about the Far East, there are films about Marines taking islands.
Yes, yes.
Sounds Iwo Jima and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think Halls of Montezuma is like that as well. But you're right. I haven't seen Objective Burma. At some point, we will do Objective Burma. Yeah. I'm guessing that's...
Which is an earlier film than this.
Yeah, that's End of the War and Errol Flynn. And I suspect we may have some gratuitous American action in that one as well. Yes, an extraordinary mission. I remember writing the obituary of a Gurkha who'd got the VC somewhere in this neck of the woods. And the stories, the bit that sticks in the mind is as he takes on the Japanese machine gun nest, having run out of bullets and grenades, and the hole through which he's crawling being too narrow for his crooked blade, he picks up a stone, and that's what he uses to finally take out the nest, a rock in his hand. And you sort of, as you're reading the citation and sort of typing the obit, you think, okay, that was quite an interesting, that sounds like quite an interesting sort of afternoon in the office.
The 14th Army called themselves the Forgotten Army, and certainly by cinematographers they are.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk about the real Merrill's Marauders, or as they were known, the 5,307th Composite Unit Provisional.
Yeah, I mean, it's a less catchy title, isn't it? Or a Force Galahad, I believe, as well, yeah.
Force Galahad is good. I like Force Galahad.
Yeah. So, so this is like, comes out of the Quebec Conference, I believe, which is one of the sort of interwar, strategic conferences, in which it's decided it would be useful to have an American unit fighting in Burma alongside the British and Imperial and Empire Commonwealth forces on sort of deep penetration stuff inspired by...
Useful how?
I think politically. Right. I think politically is the answer. That, you know, it's not like 3,000 men are going to make a difference on the front. But it would be useful to show that this is something the Americans are taking. There's always the worry. So you've got in the Pacific War, there is always the worry that the Americans and the British are on quite different pages. Right. That America is responding to a Japanese attack and Britain is protecting an empire.
Right.
And the Americans might not be comfortable with Britain protecting an empire as much as they want to defeat Japan.
Yeah.
And I think from a British point of view, having Americans fighting in Burma is very, very useful in terms of being able to say, look, they damn well do think we should keep India and Burma, and look, they're helping us defend it.
Yes, it's not clear that the Americans did think that.
No. So I mean, they actively didn't by the end of the war, but yeah.
So this composite unit is put together to be...
And they're all sort of recruited. They're mainly sort of veterans of the fighting in places like Guadalcanal against out in the Pacific Islands, which is where, you know, America's land war against Japan until this point has been mostly sort of, you know, island hopping and fighting in all these different Pacific Islands. So, yeah. And this is a unit, you know, pulled together from veterans, sent to India to be trained, and sort of doing what the Chindits have been doing for the past year and a half, which are these sort of deep penetrations behind Japanese lines.
Yes. Now, we've mentioned the Chindits several times. We ought to just... This is an officer called Ord Wingate, who is a deeply unconventional creative thinker who has, in fact, fought already a sort of guerrilla war in Abyssinia, as it was then called, and he gets back to Cairo and is so unpopular that at one stage he attempts suicide, and then Wavell gets him, who's commanding in the Far East, and Wavell is a fan of Wingate and a fan of unconventional war, and he gets Wingate, I think, out to India, where the idea is basically men can go, they will go deep into the jungle, we will drop supplies to them, and they will have it. It's not clear to me how tremendously successful this idea
I don't think
is.
Any of it actually was. Now, it made for some great stories, and there are some daring operations and all of that, but I think, you know, it doesn't change the...
There's a great. They've got a decent memorial in Westminster as well. The boldest measures are the safest. Yeah, it says on it, and I think, oh, that's a good.
But lots of trekking around the jungle with lots of mules.
Yes, and there is slightly origins of special forces.
Yes.
Stuff in this, in the sense that they're learning lot. They are learning an awful lot of things about how easy this is. Yeah. This actually is, and all of the things that can kill you that aren't the enemy.
Yeah.
So they've given the Americans have given this awful name, and the journalist comes up with Merrill's Marauders.
Yes, which General is, Merrill. Yes, much better. Yeah, there's a lot of war correspondents go along, don't they?
Yeah, Brigadier General Frank Merrill.
Yeah,
I think they're certainly along for the training. I'm not sure how much of the war along for. Yeah. I think it might leave them behind. 2,750 of them. Then at the start of 1944, head into Burma to do sort of. I mean, I don't know if it counts as behind the lines if there's 2,500 of you. I sort of think the lines are wherever you are. The idea is that they will sort of, it is a flanking maneuver sort of to get behind the Japanese and cut their supply lines. And they are under the command, they are not under British command.
No, General Stilwell wants to command it. So this is the thing. So the overall commander of the Allied forces out in this bit of the war is Mountbatten, at this point. Mountbatten's got various subordinate commanders, one of whom is Joe Stilwell, an American general very associated with America's China policy around this time. And Stilwell's angry that he doesn't have any infantry under his command. So he's like, ah, here's some Americans. They can be mine.
Yeah, they might have been happier had they not been. I think we will learn. Yes, and that's another sort of political reason for this mission is that Stilwell wants to do something.
And this is the other interesting thing that, you know, in America, we tend to think of this as sort of the Burma campaign from a British point of view. The Americans think of this as what the China Burma India Theatre, I think they call it CBI.
Yeah, it's, I don't think that if even 15 years ago I would have been able to tell you that the Chinese fought in World War II.
Yes,
actually. We talk about bits of the war that are written out.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I knew that Japan had invaded China, but I somehow in my mind, I knew that Japan had invaded China because obviously I was saying the Empire of the Sun, this kind of thing, but in my mind,
yes, Chinese
that was a
fighting
different
in Burma
bit of world. Yeah. That wasn't World War II. That was something else. And then you get into, when did World War II start? And that kind of thing. So, yes. Now, when the film comes out, comes out in 1962, we're at a very interesting moment politically in America.
Yes.
So the Korean War has just finished.
Yes.
Which slightly explains why you never see any Chinese soldiers.
But and it's phenomenal to do a film about, you know, Joe Stilwell, like, you know, the big biography of him by Barbara Tuchin is called Stilwell in China. You know, it's like the association of Stilwell is the guy that was in China in World War II. You make a film which he's a character. And there are no Chinese people.
Because they've just been fighting against the Chinese.
Yes,
they don't want to get into a discussion about how a decade earlier they were fighting alongside the Chinese. This kind of thing just makes people ask questions. And I mean, it's interesting. You do get the impression at various points that Americans are quite hazy about the geography, even on bits of the world where a reasonable number of them died.
Yes.
But the Vietnam War conflict is at this point it's not really an American war at this point. I think it's still French Indochina, is it? I don't know. Maybe
it's South Vietnam by now. Kennedy is sending advisors and they're slowly ramping up involvement, but it's not, you know, it's after 64 that you get to big ground force deployments.
The other interesting thing about this film in terms of why it was made and so on, the trailer for it.
The trailer's tremendous. I had never seen the trailer.
Which is on Amazon.
The trailer,
and if you don't even watch the film, just watch the trailer. Because tell us about the trailer.
Well, trailers... Sorry, the things about this film, to say, is it's filmed in the Philippines with the Philippine Army and real US Special Forces. Mm. And whoever was doing the marketing of this film clearly decided that was a really, really big selling point.
Yeah. So the other thing, there is also, I think you and I have seen different trailers, because the trailer I saw is just an American Special Forces soldier, the senior Special Forces commander. No, this is the one, right, that we were talking, because I said to Duncan, listeners, you've got to see the trailer on Amazon. It's amazing.
So, I watched a trailer on YouTube.
Yeah, no, you have to get, well, just...
Sorry, I'll follow your more
do
precise
as you're told. This is why you're back with the mule train. It is just a Special Forces commander talking about American Special Forces and why this film that's coming out, Merrill's Marauders, is so special.
This sounds tremendous.
It's absolutely brilliant. It's just, I don't even know if it has any scenes in the film. It's just a very senior... very senior man who shortly will be sending people to their deaths in Vietnam, leaning on his desk and saying, you've got to see the great untold story of World War II.
Now, see, this actually makes a lot of sense to me now, because in the early 60s, basically Kennedy is obsessed with Special Forces.
Right.
So from 1960, well, Kennedy wins in November 1960, 1961, 62, the film comes out in 62, Kennedy is obsessed by the Special Forces. There's loads of people around the administration who think this is the future. So like the entire White House press corps are dragged down to Fort Benning or whatever it is in Georgia to watch Special Forces training because they're really, really into it. So it makes sense to me. There will have been an awful lot of news coverage in late 61, 62 about Special Forces. So I can see why they might have thought this was a good trailer.
Right. No, that makes sense. And you can see, again, you can sort of see that this is a... because this is a film about jungle warfare on, and this is a film about jungle warfare before Vietnam has happened. So it means a different thing.
This is jungle warfare when it's sort of veterans of Guadalcanal who know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Going into a different jungle. It's not, you know,
it's not
19, 20-year-old draft number came up finding themselves in
the Bronx.
It's,
So let's go to the after action report. Dad, they're on the cable car. I mean, the sort of the structure of this film, the first 20 minutes of it, I thought, well, this is great fun.
Yeah.
I can see why, I can sort of see why 10-year-old Duncan loved this film. Yeah. You've got, you know, good-hearted US testosterone oozing off the screen.
It's a hard opening as well.
Yeah.
It's just like, here we go. This is what the film is, you know.
And then by the end of it, it's a quite different film.
Yeah.
And I was completely suckered, not knowing what I was, because I'd never seen this before, not knowing, I was completely suckered in, if you see
what
I mean.
It's not a film. Yeah,
I thought it feels very John Wayne at the start.
Yes, and I think it's a fascinating film for the early 60s, because it almost feels at times it almost feels like a post-Vietnam War film. Mm.
Yeah, no, well, there's all sorts of reasons why you couldn't have made it post-Vietnam, but by the ending of it, it's much more subtle. I mean, it's the director is Sam Fuller, who will go on to make The Big Red One.
Yes, which is a great film.
Which is the film he wants to make at this point, because he had been in 1st Infantry, The Big Red One, and that's the story he wants to tell. Yeah. And he can't get the money for it. And somebody says to him, if you make this, we'll give you the money for The Big Red One. And then he falls out with them. Actually, he falls out with them because I think he wanted a different ending.
Okay.
And they say, well, you can't make The Big Red One. Yeah. So we have to wait another sort of 20 years. So he has he's a combat veteran who sort of has quite a specific view of all of this. And, well, we will come to what happened to Merrill's Marauders. But there is a limit to how John Wayne-y you can make this story.
You know what I think is really, really interesting? In some ways, you know, one of the categories we sometimes speak about is commando movie, and there are aspects of commando movie in this film. Very, very unusually for lots of these big American war movies, it just has none of the usual tropes. Like, usually, if you're going to focus on some men, you know, you'll have one from a ranch in the Midwest or Texas or something, or some very Christian, the ones just married. Those tropes aren't there.
Well, there are some. I think I'm going to disagree with you here because there are different set of tropes.
Yes.
Right. So and they don't even really bother with character names.
No, you don't. So need them.
So let's look at the names of some of the characters. You've got Bullseye. What do you think Bullseye might be good at? You've got
darts.
You've got Chowhound.
Yeah.
You've got Muley.
Yeah.
Who looks after the mule? Yeah. I mean, this is nominative determinism at another level. We can't even be bothered to call them Smith and Jones.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've got the sort of the paternal relationship between Merrill, the commander, and the young lieutenant, who does have a name. He isn't actually just called Young Lieutenant, but
West Point.
Lutie. Second Lieutenant Lee Stockton.
Yeah.
What I thought is it's not quite a commando film, because in a commando film, there is more of the, you know, here's the best man with a knife I've ever met.
Yeah.
Here's the explosives expert.
Yeah.
You know, it's more of a unit thing in the sense that there's lots of unit films in which you have one guy who's a crack shot.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of thing. That what you don't have, but you don't have many of these characters. You don't have one guy who's a joker.
Yes. It's a film which really goes into issues around morale and all of this in a way which, again, just feels unlike a lot of, you know, you said, you know, you thought this was going to be like a John Wayne 1960s movie.
Yeah.
It's very much not a John Wayne 1960s movie. You know, it's morale, it's physical exhaustion, it's just, you know, marching hundreds of miles through jungle, mountainous jungle at that, just isn't very pleasant.
And the sort of the arc of the story is, you open with this great action sequence. You can understand where everyone is. You can understand how it all fits together. And you think, as I say, you think this is going to be one kind of war film. And by the end of it, it's just men clinging on.
Yeah.
The marauders do make their way deep into Burma. Yeah. 750 miles?
Yeah, in about 5 months or something.
Yeah, they are fighting all the way.
Yeah, and this is really, this is some of the harshest, thickest jungle on Earth, and it's mountainous.
And
lots of it.
Why they might not have been grateful that they were under an American command, Stillwell has determined that they can do this on lighter rations.
Yes, so historically what's happened is the Americans have something called a jungle ration. Stillwell has decided there's no need for that. They can use the standard K ration, which is,
When would you use the jungle ration?
So the K ration is, it's meant to give you 3 meals a day.
Yeah.
I think it's just over 2,000 calories.
Somewhere,
But people don't eat all of it because some of it is just really bad. So you lose calories that way. It's not very bulky stuff either. 2,000 calories a day should be all right, unless you're trekking through.
Unless you're fighting your way through mountainous jungle terrain.
Yes, there's a stat that the people that made it through, the average weight loss was 25 pounds over 5 months. So what, getting towards 2 stone in 5 months is, it's a good Weight Watchers diet. Not one I'd recommend.
And we will come back to the people who make it through, not a lot of the people make it through.
But the film goes into
it captures that completely, and it's sort of set up from the start. You've got this character called Doc. We never quite established what his job is. Mm-hmm. Doc, who is responsible obviously for the medical welfare of the whole unit, and at the start he's just worrying about Meryl, but quite quickly he realizes that he's got quite a lot of them to worry about. Yeah. There's a tremendous arc to the final scene where, first of all, you've got this sort of battle, what they call the Banzai Charge.
Japanese Charge.
Then the sort of the Meryl, and this, I mean, Meryl, this is true. General Meryl had his second heart attack around this time.
Yeah.
A young man as well. And this inspires his men, exhausted and bloody, to get up and take the hill, as it were. And it's... I read a description of it where somebody, a memoir where a guy was writing about, by this stage he had dysentery, he's passing blood.
Yeah.
All he wants is to be unconscious. He doesn't care if the Japanese take the line. I think it does completely capture.
Yeah.
That's the level that they're fighting at. Yeah. She's not so dumb. There are women in this film. There are Burmese women.
Yeah, but you
I mean, none of them are a great character.
No.
You're not winning the Oscar. They're used to good effect because you get the sort of, you do get the slightly tropey sort of American officer saves Burmese woman bit, but there is also actually when an older woman is feeding one of the soldiers and he's just crying.
Yeah.
At that point, you think, okay, right. That's good. That's a well-done scene. Now, I had been, up until 2 hours ago, I had been going to say that there are essentially no future stars in this film.
Have you found one?
I did find one. Well, I say that. Are you familiar with the career of Peter Brown?
No.
Well, I stumbled across one of the best website guides to this film is on the Peter Brown fan site.
Who did Peter Brown play?
He's Bullseye.
Okay. And what did Peter Brown go on to do?
Well, you see, you sit there going through the list and you go, where's the reason why a Peter Brown fan club exists? He's in American TV Westerns. And actually, a lot of the actors in this were TV actors.
Yeah.
And he's one of them. And apparently, if you... I can't even remember what they're called. But if you watched American TV Westerns
you will
in
have
the
seen.
60s, you will... This guy was a senior player in a couple of them.
Well, there we go. Peter Brown.
Yeah, Peter Brown. And if you're in the Peter Brown fan club and you've just come to this podcast, can I just say how welcome you are?
I mean, it makes sense, these lot of TV actors. You get the impression the budget for this wasn't huge. And I think they do a very good job with it.
Yeah.
But it's not a massive budget movie, is it?
No. It's made with US Army support. It's also, they're filming in the Philippines and they called themselves, I think, the United States Film Production Company. And at some point, they realized, this may have been deliberate, but the people of the Philippines are convinced that this means that they are there on behalf of the United States government.
Ah.
And they are quite happy to allow this misapprehension to continue. So let's turn to the casualty list. Well, I can't find a movie body count, but why don't you take me through the actual body count of the Meryl's Marauders mission?
So, it's quite high. 2,750 members of Meryl's Marauders entered Burma. The end of the operation, only about 200 surviving members of the Marauders were present. When it was finally disbanded in August 1944, the 5,307th Provisional Combat Team had 130 combat effective men and officers. The stat I absolutely love just breaks up the terror of this. Of the 2,750 men who entered Burma, only two were alive at the end who had never been hospitalized by wounds or major illness.
You can find in the podcast universe a really interesting interview with a medical officer from the Marauders. I mean, just search Meryl's Marauders and you'll find it. And I mean, he has views.
It's dysentery, isn't it? It's malaria.
It's all sorts of things. It's as much as it's the enemy shooting at you, it's all of the other stuff. They get all kinds of weird. Again, this is sort of hinted at in the film that there are things that are wrong with the men that they're not telling the men about because they can't treat them.
Yeah.
When they hook up with the Chinese, alongside whom they are actually fighting, it turns out that they all get dysentery because the Chinese like to go to the loo in the water. In the streams. And this doesn't bother the Chinese because the Chinese also all boil their drinking water.
Yes.
But the Americans don't boil their drinking water. And again, I think we have to lay this one at Stilwell's door. There were sort of senior Americans trying to put men back into the line who plainly shouldn't have been in the line. And then there are accounts of, you know, the medics sort of running after trucks trying to get men off. Yeah. It all just sounds absolutely grim.
I mean, it's an horrifically managed operation in many regards.
And I think... when they sort of get to their final objective, and by this stage Merrill is no longer in command because he's had his second heart attack, and the colonel who has taken over command writes an account of all of this. I can't remember why he's denouncing. I don't know whether it's Stilwell he's denouncing or why, but he sends this letter, which ultimately will lead to a sort of congressional inquiry and other things. But first of all, ends his career.
Yeah,
you know, this is an absolute horror show.
Yeah.
Well, the Cooler King Award for the most gratuitous American character.
I mean, you could argue the entire unit
is
gratuitous.
Yes, I'm giving it to Merrill's Marauders. Yes. Because they were, I mean, they at least mentioned the fact that there are British off somewhere else.
Yes.
The fact that they never mentioned the Chinese. I mean, it was only when I was doing the research afterwards, I was like, oh, gosh, they talk about the Chinese quite a lot, the people who were actually there. He's bought it a Sarge Award for the best death. I mean, I've got the Japanese. There's an awful lot of Japanese dying in this. The Banzai charges are sort of, if you like this kind of thing. I've got Muley dying at the top of the mountain. We made it, Eleanor. And then he drops. I mean, you do sort of understand that basically men are just now dropping dead from...
Oh, yeah. And yeah, I should have added to the body count, none of the horses and only 41 of the mules survived.
Eleanor doesn't make it. But actually, my favourite death is the man who keeps asking, "Did Lemdek make it? Did Lemdek make it?" And the doctor says, "Yes, Lemdek made it." And the man leans back and dies. And the general says, "Who's Lemdek?" And did Lemdek make it? And he said, "That's Lemdek." I can't find a credit for who played Lemdek or indeed a mention of Lemdek or how you spell Lemdek, but Lemdek is my best.
I think Lemdek probably gets. I think the Banzai charges, though, they're just really well shot as well. You don't often get it that sort of visceral, I don't think.
Who has the stiffest upper lip here? Merrill? Doc?
Yeah, I think Merrill or Doc. I think Merrill's just, you know, Merrill has fanned himself in this ridiculous and awful situation, which is getting worse and worse and worse. He has not enough resources to do what he has to do, and what he has to do keeps being upped. And he copes with it in quite a sort of, stoic way, I think.
He is given, about two-thirds of the way through, he's sort of given the choice not to continue.
Yeah.
And he opts to continue.
Yes.
And obviously the film is sort of presenting this as a heroic moment. I have to say, at a distance of 60 years, I was sort of thinking, you could stop.
Yeah, it's interesting. But I guess this film is, 18 or so years later, in which this will still have been regarded as a, the people that made it will have been rightly very proud of this. And I guess,
at the time of recording, there is still one Merrill's Marauder left alive. I mean, one died, the second to last one died at the age of 101. And again, I mean, if you are listening, word, man.
Yeah.
Well done. But let's skip forward slightly to the Broadsword Radio Award for the most completely implausible moment. There is a point in this where Stilwell explains that his greatest fear is that the Japanese will link up with the Germans.
Yes, yes, yes.
It is early 1944 at this point, and we're talking about the Japanese fighting in Burma and being pushed back in Burma, to be clear.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where are the other Germans at this point?
The other Germans at this point are somewhere along a line through central Belarusia and central eastern Ukraine.
Would you like to guess how many miles that is?
from Burma to central Belarus miles? 2,000-ish?
3,500.
3,500. 3,500. Well, I worried 2,000, I'd be worried, but...
I don't think that the Japanese are, in fact, going to link up with the Germans and threaten anything.
There's a line which comes to mind. Lord Salisbury, when he was British Prime Minister in the 19th century, was once asked, you know, why does Britain really care about who controls Constantinople, modern Istanbul? Because it's always spoken of in terms of if Constantinople is controlled by the Russians, then India will be under threat. And he replied, it mainly comes from statesmen using maps on too small a scale. Which I think is, this feels like the same sort of issue that, yes, the Japanese army are not going to link up with the Germans.
Yes. I mean, at a deep level, and not to diminish the undeniable heroism of the real men who did this, it is never clear to me at any point in this film whether any of these men need to be doing this hellish thing.
Yes. Now, it's interesting because I can't imagine Stillwell actually said that. So obviously it's inserted into the film. And I wonder if even by the early 60s, we're already in sort of a frame where World War II is fought against the Germans.
Yes.
So if we're doing a film where World War II isn't fought against the Germans, we need a line explaining why this is partially about the Germans.
If anybody thinks the World War II is against the Japanese, it's the Americans.
Yes, exactly.
Surely.
I
think it's obvious if you're an American why you're hopping from island to island, you know, in a Japanward direction.
Yeah.
It may be harder if you're an American to understand
why you're fighting why you're protecting Burma. Yes,
India. And to be fair, it is quite hard to understand.
Yeah.
I mean, also, we are looking at this through the lens that we know that what will end this war is not, in fact, American troops arriving in Japan.
Yes.
The Dan Busters Dog Prize for problematic moments. The thing that I feel uneasy about in these films when I watch them now, and I don't know whether this is just my modern woke sensibilities, how do we feel about the treatment of the Japanese in these films?
Yes. It's difficult. They're never really given... They're never characters. They're sort of almost caricature monsters.
And they are just guys who will, you know...
Keep charging at you.
And I mean, slightly, I guess that's probably how the war felt.
Yeah.
Clint Eastwood films about Iwo Jima are actually quite sensitive on all of this. And even the one that's from the American perspective, you get a sense of, okay, right, these are real people. I have to say, Bridge on the River Kwai has an important Japanese character who is a man with interesting motivations and so on. Though when we get to it, you'll find out that the true story was even better. I can't wait to do Bridge on the River Kwai.
But no, you're right. But I think certainly even by the 60s, you know, sort of portrayal of the Germans in cinema has moved on a bit, whereas the Japanese it never quite does. I don't think.
Yes, we are by the 60s. We are allies with the Germans against the Russians.
Yeah, but Japan's an ally as well. I mean, not militarily, but I think what the charges in this film, you know, very reminiscent. You know, the Japanese army did do this in the Second World War, but it's also a tactic the Chinese were using in Korea the decade before. And I think, you know, for a lot of the American audience, familiar not just with the Second World War, but the Korean War as well, this will have felt more present than it does today.
I think, I mean, some of the combat sequences from this film, I think, are taken from other films. Some of the scenes.
So it's definitely one way to keep the budget down.
Yes, well, you do feel like there's a budget, you know. Yeah. Judgment at Nuremberg. How many war crimes are committed in this? I mean, we said when we were talking about Paths of Glory that it's not a war crime to abuse your own troops.
Yeah. I can't think of a specific war crime.
I mean, it's basically US commanders.
Really screwing it up. But yeah.
They made up surprisingly little of this.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. It's based on a non-fiction book, isn't it?
I mean, the other amazing thing about this film that gives it a level of pathos is that the man who plays Merrill, Jeff Chandler, dies essentially immediately after making it.
And very, very young, wasn't he?
Yes. I mean, younger. He's one of these actors who had, because he was prematurely grey, he tended to get asked to play men slightly older.
Early 40s, though.
Yes.
Yeah.
And...
We're defining early 40s as very, very young, Rob. That's very
we
important.
We certainly are. So he's playing baseball with some of the American soldiers who are sort of extras. And I don't even quite. It does something to his back, and so when he eventually goes back, he has an op, and the op goes wrong, and
he dies.
And yeah. He dies, which is a sort of so there's sort of the level of pathos that in a certainly when you sort of find that out just after watching it, you think, my goodness, actually this film did really kill people. Yeah. It seems slightly glib, but
How big a star was he? Obviously, his career was cut off.
He's a contract player.
Which is a big thing in sort of 50s, 60s, yes. Hollywood, isn't it?
He's got good looks. I'm trying to see what he's known for. Known for Broken Arrow, Man. According to IMDb, this is not even the film he's known for. You sort of feel like if he's not a leading man, I think he's on the poster for Man in the Shadow. Broken Arrow obviously is a James Stewart film. He's on the poster for Female on the Beach with Joan Crawford. He's listed. He's topping the billing in Yankee Buccaneer.
There we go.
I don't think he's Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
But I think people knew who he was.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean. Duncan, is this the operation that changed the course of World War II?
No, it's not. But it is.
Is it at least the operation that changed the course of the war in Burma?
No, it's not. It's not. Right. But it's nice to see some attention on the Burma campaign. So I'll give it marks for that.
I think that's the thing. Partly is that the Burma campaign ultimately doesn't matter.
Okay. Hold on one moment. I mean, if so, you know, it's Field Marshal.
Grandson of the 10th Army.
It's 45. So Field Marshal Slim, commander at that. You know, he takes over an army which is wrecked. He turns them around. They drive the Japanese back into Burma. Right. Had that not happened, the Japanese would have actually been able to invade India. Now, does this change the course of the war? No. But the politics of a Japanese army actually making it into India would have been very, very messy. You don't quite know what the various, you know, anti-British colonial rule parties would have done. It would have complicated the war in Asia a lot.
There are sort of independence activists in India who are
very much not on our side. There are some. Yes, the Indian National Army is fighting alongside the Japanese, and sort of, and some British, some Indian prisoners of war who were fighting alongside the Brits when they're captured enter, you know, fighting alongside the Japanese. It's a messy conflict, but I think it matters that the bulk of it takes place in Burma rather than in India proper.
Right. Okay. So the Burma campaign, if it doesn't change the course of World War II, at least keeps World War II on course.
Yes, I think that's fair.
But
this operation
doesn't change the course of the campaign. But you know, what a bunch of guys. Worth dying for?
I think it's a good film.
I rented it thinking I will watch this and I will never watch it again.
Yeah.
I mean, I slightly regretted that because I thought actually I could better watch it.
Yeah, so it's the third time. I first saw it in, I presume, the 80s, late 80s, early 90s. I saw it again about 10 or 15 years ago when I was sort of flicking through channels and came across it in a way that one rarely flicks through channels.
Yes.
10, 15
years. I don't even understand the words you're using.
Yeah, yeah. And then I watched it again for this, and I thought, actually, I'm pleased to have seen it three times. It's got surprising depth for a early 1960s war movie. It's got more focus on sort of morale and what happens when logistics go horribly wrong than many other films of that type, but coupled with quite good action sequences, some of which may have been borrowed from previous films.
Yes, yeah.
I think quite good storytelling, good cast.
You can see where the Big Red One comes from. I want to watch the Big Red One again now and see how that fits in. Merrill's Marauders. Thanks for listening. Next week, we're fighting the Battle of the Atlantic in the Cruel Sea. We'll be right back.